I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. In April, President Donald Trump didn't know about any payments made to Stephanie Clifford, who works as Stormy Daniels in the adult film business. Yesterday, he did know about the payments. He also surely knows that Ms. Clifford is suing him. Mr. Trump has two new lawyers this week, Rudy Giuliani, a former prosecutor and New York mayor, and Emmett Flood, a former impeachment lawyer for Bill Clinton. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has a long list of questions he'd like to ask the president, and today on the News Wrap, I'll pose some questions to our panel. Aisha Rasko, who covers the White House for NPR, Andy Green, the editor of the Baltimore Sun opinion page, and Malia Cromer, the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. We'll talk national and local politics when the Midday News Wrap starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We are on our way to a three-peat here in Baltimore. If we make it past 90 degrees today, which we may have already, I need to check that, it will be the third day in a row of record-breaking heat. And yes, you know this is coming. Of course, Washington, D.C. and the Southern District of New York have heated up considerably this week. An adult film star is suing the President of the United States. That's something I never thought I'd say when my career in radio began. The aforementioned president added the former mayor of New York to his ever-changing legal team. Rudy Giuliani then proceeded to directly contradict the president's earlier claims about hush money paid to the aforementioned adult film star. President's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, remains in legal trouble as a troubleshooter for Bill Clinton and George W. Bush joins the list of Trump legal dramatis personae. Emmett Flood is replacing Ty Cobb on the legal team. A list of questions that special counsel Robert Mueller apparently has for President Trump was made public this week. Speculation followed at a fevered pitch as to what evidence Mueller has and still wants to have in his ongoing investigation. The Boy Scouts are dropping the boy part. The Nobel Prize in Literature is dropping their effort to make an award this year, and Adidas is under pressure to drop Kanye West after he suggested slavery was a choice. And it seems we all spend a big part of every day waiting for the other shoe to drop across a multitude of topics. Trump and Scott Pruitt and the EPA and Kim Jong-un and even the chaplain of Congress. He was dropped over a prayer and then rehired. We'll start today with a look at some national stories, and we'll move on to several local issues later in the program. With us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. is Aisha Rasko. She is an NPR White House reporter, and before coming to NPR, she covered the White House for Reuters. Aisha, welcome, and welcome to NPR.
Hi, Tom, and thank you.
It's good to have you back on our show, and I'm saying welcome to NPR like I own NPR, which I don't, but still, you've crossed on over to the dark side of radio, and we are delighted to have you. And here in Studio A, I'm joined by Andy Green. He's the Baltimore Sun editorial page editor. Mr. Green, always a pleasure.
Great to see you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, listeners, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, to find us on Twitter at midday. WYPR. So, Aisha, this business with Giuliani, who went on Sean Hannity's show a couple nights ago and basically said a bunch of stuff that the president of the United States has said wasn't true just a few days before. And then the president had some comments about it even this morning on his way to Dallas to address the NRA. In this ever-changing minute-by-minute story, can you get us up to date on what was said and what was unsaid? So far?
I can get us up to date to where we are now. As you said, it has been changing. So you had Rudy Giuliani go on Fox News and basically make this announcement that President Trump had paid his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, had reimbursed him for paying Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress. And after that, President Trump tweeted the following morning, seemingly confirming that, saying that he had been paying Michael Cohen a retainer, and that monthly retainer had been used to reimburse him. He said these types of arrangements aren't unusual, and non-disclosure agreements when you're rich and famous and making those type of payments are not unusual. But then today, President Trump seemed to take a different tone. He was heading out to Dallas for the NRA convention, and he said Giuliani, he was basically saying that Giuliani is new, that he's still learning, and that he will get his facts straight. He said that that Giuliani would be releasing some type of statement. And he also said that most of the reporting and everything out about this issue has been incorrect, but he didn't really correct it in his statement. So I'm not really sure where the White House is going right now with this, or where President Trump is going to come out on who paid who when and what they knew and when. But those are the questions right now.
Boy, and there are a lot of questions, Andy Green. This has always been a story that's been a lot of smoke. We haven't necessarily found any fire, either with Mr. Cohen's personal issues with the attorneys in New York or the prosecutors in New York, or Mr. Trump's issues with Mr. Mueller. But boy, putting the smoke back in the box once it's out of the box seems awfully hard.
I'm not sure who thought bringing Rudy Giuliani into the situation was a good idea. I mean, remember, this is the same guy whose remark a couple of years ago about how President Trump was, I guess it's only 1 year ago now, a year and a half, about how President Trump was trying to find a legal way to do his campaign promise of a Muslim ban, helped single-handedly get a couple iterations of that struck down in court. This is not exactly the most disciplined guy in these sorts of circumstances. And particularly, you know, you don't want your lawyer to be the star of the show, and Rudy Giuliani is the star of his own show. So this is not super shocking. But it does clear up possibly some issues related to the possibility that this could have been a campaign finance violation, the payment to Stormy Daniels, but may have created other legal issues related to different campaign finance laws. So it's not clear that it helped anything, may have in some ways hurt. And then there was something else he said during the interview, which put the firing of James Comey back in the spotlight in terms of whether the president was attempting to obstruct justice in any way in doing that. So all in all, not a super helpful debut from the former New York mayor.
Yeah, one would think. And Aisha, the New York Times is reporting that Mr. Cohen, Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, was put on a retainer. I guess that began in January or something, right after the inauguration. And so it's not just, doesn't appear that he was reimbursed just the $130,000 that Ms. Clifford, who performs as Stormy Daniels, was paid, but that amount now has totaled, it totals some nearly $500,000 because it's a monthly retainer of, I guess, $35,000 a month. Is the president, did the president have anything more to say about that? Is this just sort of normal business that this is his personal lawyer and he keeps him on a retainer and he pays him a lot of money every month for that privilege?
No, we don't have any more details on these payments. And the White House has been very cagey about this. They'll say, you know, you have to talk to his outside, to President Trump's outside lawyers about this. Of course, Rudy Giuliani is the outside lawyer. And apparently we have to question some of the things that he's telling us. So we don't know about the payment arrangement. And that's where a lot of the questions are, is, OK, he's being paid this retainer. It's not just for reimbursement, it's for other things. But then there's also this question, because Michael Cohen is also under another investigation in New York. His offices were raided by the FBI. There's a question of how much actual legal work he was doing. So what else was President Trump paying him for? Because it also doesn't seem like he did a lot of legal work. So all of these questions are coming up, and they haven't been answered. And what's interesting from Rudy Giuliani is that there was this argument that he was getting this revelation out there about about President Trump reimbursing Michael Cohen, to just get it out there and get it out of the way. But really, the way that they've presented it, it raises more questions. So it didn't really do what they were trying to do, because instead of silencing this issue, it really raised more kind of doubts and questions about what exactly is going on.
Yeah, and Andy Green, maybe one of the things that they're trying to have silenced, or one of the people they're having trying to have silenced, is Michael Cohen.
Right. There was a lot of speculation early on that this was not just some slip of the tongue by Mr. Giuliani, that in fact this was orchestrated to whatever degree the Trump White House orchestrates anything, and followed up particularly by the president's series of three tweets the next morning, which were unusually well punctuated and spell-checked, and no stray capital letters of the sort that any reader of the president's Twitter account has grown to know and love. It looked like somebody had actually taken some time and thought this through. It was almost like a statement being released as opposed to tweets, which led a lot of people to think, oh, they are doing this deliberately. They want to show Michael Cohen that they are not going to throw him to the wolves, because perhaps they're worried about what he might or might not say, and you know, whether he might agree to cooperate with prosecutors and provide more evidence or testimony related to who knows what. But, you know, again, that's all speculation. We have no idea.
Yeah, and Aisha Sarah Sanders, the White House spokesperson, seemed to be caught off guard with these particular developments. And there are a lot of people in Washington, certainly the punditry class, saying that Mr. Cohen has flipped, that he is now in the bag for special counsel Robert Mueller. What's the mood in the White House as regards Mr. Cohen's putative loyalty to Donald Trump, who seems to be his only legal client?
Well, we definitely don't know whether he's flipped or not, or whether he's cooperating. I think when it comes to the White House staff, these changes in the information with President Trump saying explicitly he didn't know anything about the payment, and then it comes out that, well, actually he did, or he just recently found out. I think that it definitely puts Sarah Sanders, White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders, in a difficult position. She wants to make the argument that she's acting on the best information that she has. But when these things happen, you have to question the information that she's getting and whether everyone is being kept in the loop. She was trying to say in the latest briefing that, you know, that the White House is not talking to the outside lawyers, and so they're not coordinating. But it seems like on some of these broader issues where the White House is going to have to answer for these things, that there would have to be some type of communication. Or you would think there would be.
Yeah, you certainly would think there would be, Andy Green. And there are a lot of people who think that Giuliani really has put Mr. Trump in deeper hot water. I mean, he's raised the temperature of the water and he's made the pool deeper by saying some of these things, that this really, as Aisha was saying, didn't by any means accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, which was to have everybody move on from the Michael
right.
Cohen stuff and the Stormy Daniels stuff. But it really gave more grist for the mill of Special Counsel Mueller.
Yeah, I mean, there are, as we said, two separate things going on here. The Stormy Daniels situation is, so far as we know, not something that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is paying attention to. He didn't, among the 49 questions, which I imagine we'll get to shortly, that the New York Times reported he was interested in asking, nothing about any of that. It's all related to Russia, the election, and items stemming from that. But there was a lot of thought that the Stormy Daniels case could get the president in legal trouble for campaign finance violations. You know, how serious that is, how much a prosecutor would go after him for that, hard to say. But Giuliani's performance certainly didn't totally clear that up. You know, there may be, instead of an illegal contribution, you may be looking at an unreported loan, whether the president is using his personal funds for effectively a campaign purpose without disclosing that. You know, there are a lot of questions that Giuliani's remarks raised rather than shutting the door on them.
Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Aisha Roscoe is an NPR White House reporter. We're going to take a quick break. We will have more with Aisha and Andy when we return, and we will talk about the questions that Mr. Mueller has for Mr. Trump, and we will take your questions and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. You can find me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. You're listening to Midday, and we are very grateful for that. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, quick word about Monday's program ahead of Tuesday's school board budget vote. Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Dr. Sonia Santelises joins me here in Studio A to discuss her proposed budget, which includes $5.5 million in cuts to the city's public charter schools, as well as some increases for a project that she's very, very closely aligned with, her literacy coaching program. We'll also talk about falling enrollment and a bit of a controversy surrounding a task force that she has assembled to address that problem. So that's all coming up with Dr. Sonia Santelises Monday here on Midday. If you're just joining us, it's the Midday News Wrap. I'm joined by NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, who is on the line from NPR headquarters in Washington, and Baltimore Sun editorial page editor Andy Green, who's here with me in the studio. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org. If you're in the Twittersphere, at midday, WYPR. So Aisha, these 49 questions that Special Counsel Mueller's team evidently has prepared for the president, and I've heard several legal scholars say that behind each of those 49 questions is a whole bunch of sub-questions. So the number of questions is actually much greater than 49. The reaction of the White House to the release of these questions and to what it portends about the president's possible agreeing to undergo questioning by the special counsel.
The White House officials said that this leak was, they called it, you know, disheartening, and they were concerned about it. Now, they were saying that they were concerned about this leak. There are questions about where this leak came from and who would benefit from releasing these questions, but we don't know exactly where the questions came from. But the White House publicly was basically saying that this is a disgrace and this isn't good that this private information is leaking. As far as whether President Trump would be willing to talk to Mueller, he addressed that again today. And even after the questions came out and he had talked about the questions weren't, none of them were about collusion, which isn't true. There were questions about relating to Russia and interactions with Russia. But he had complained about the questions and complained about what had happened with Michael Cohen. But he said today that he would be willing to talk to Mueller. He said that he believes he's done nothing wrong. He said no collusion. He added in no obstruction. And he said that if he would be treated fairly, that he would talk to Mueller and he would even override his lawyers as long as he thought he would be treated fairly.
And of course, in addition to collusion and obstruction, if the president speaks to the special counsel, Andy Green, under oath, then the notion of the possibility of perjury immediately goes on the table, because Mr. Trump has a very difficult time going for 15 minutes straight without uttering something that is patently untrue.
So it would seem, yes. I find it sort of amusing that everybody is talking about Mueller cleverly setting him in a perjury trap. Although, you know, it seems that all you need to do is put him under oath and he may well contradict himself within moments. And so we've sort of baked in the idea that the president has a very casual relationship with the truth and that he famously is not prepared for these sorts of things. And that was a whole other avenue of commentary there. But Rudy Giuliani, another of the things he said this week is that they're not going to set themselves up for a Mueller perjury trap. They're not going to send him in for open-ended inquiries, that they want this to be sort of tight and focused. But, you know, as you say, these are not 49 questions. They're 49 topics of inquiry, and there would be who knows how many follow-up questions beyond that. You know, I read a former federal prosecutor saying, basically from the looks of this, this is a, you know, two-day interview minimum to get through all of this stuff. And it covers a very wide range of things, you know, from the campaign through the transition into the first year in the White House, relating both to issues of possible criminal conspiracy with Russia to influence the election, and then on to questions that would be related to obstruction of justice in terms of, you know, what the president did or didn't do in terms of trying to stop legal action against members of his administration, or in firing James Comey, or considering firing the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, among other things. So there's a lot of ground there to cover.
Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun, Aisha Roscoe of NPR, who covers the White House for NPR. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Janet in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Aisha Roscoe and Andy Green.
Hello. I have a paper copy of the Sun paper from Wednesday. It says that Trump's lawyers prepared a list of nearly four dozen questions that could be posed during a potential interview with the president. And I think the important thing here is that the president is responding to these questions in public for the American public and contradicting himself. Whereas the actual Mueller investigation, well, they say that a sitting president cannot be indicted. So my question is there some kind of a threshold whereby a city, such as if he commits a physical crime, is there some kind of a threshold whereby a sitting president could be indicted or at least temporarily removed from office? And doesn't that raid on Dr. Bornstein's office, which appears to be a strong-arm robbery, would not that qualify as a crime for which...
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Janet. We get your drift. Aisha, the White House lawyers and even Mr. Mueller's team itself appeared to be... unsure about the legality, the constitutionality of indicting a sitting president. What have they been saying about that lately?
Well, this is something that legal scholars will argue about, and it hasn't really been played out whether a sitting president can be indicted. Some would argue that a sitting president cannot be indicted for a crime, but after he leaves office, or he or she leaves office, that charges could be pursued against them. Ultimately, the way that we know that you can remove a president from office if he has committed a crime would be through impeachment. And that is obviously has political implications. It's not just a legal process. There is this question of what Robert Mueller would be able to compel President Trump to do and how far he wants to go. Does he want to subpoena the president and bring him before a grand jury? And obviously, if that happened, President Trump would likely fight that. And then we don't know what the outcome would be. We don't know, you know, that could end up in the Supreme Court. This could be months-long, drawn-out process. So there's a question of whether Mueller wants to go through that, whether he's willing to kind of go that route. And so there's a question of how much power Mueller has to really make the president submit to questioning.
And Andy Green, our caller Janet alluded to this weird affair with Dr. Harold Bornstein, who was Mr. Trump's personal physician. During the campaign, he released a somewhat bizarre report on the president's health, which it turns out he, the doctor, didn't write.
Yes.
In fact, it appears that it was dictated directly by Mr. Trump, which doesn't come as a surprise to anybody in the medical profession who read that particular report. When these things happen, when these just blatant lies happen, for example, on Air Force One, he's saying, I don't know anything about no $130,000. And then 5 days later, he knows everything about it. There's the court of public opinion, and then there's the special counsel, et cetera. But boy, you got to wonder how this thing gets itself worked out.
Well, you do want the idea that the president says things that turn out not to be true, I think, is pretty well baked in at this point, and people either care or they don't, and a substantial percentage of people apparently don't care. Back to the question of the subpoena, it's interesting to look back at the history of the Whitewater investigation. Ken Starr indicated that he tried to subpoena President Clinton to appear, and at the time, nobody was really sure whether he could be forced to give testimony. President Clinton, backed down and agreed to testify, perhaps perhaps not in his best interests as things would turn out. But we do have precedent from that era that a president can be compelled to testify in a civil case, which he did in the Paula Jones litigation. That went to the Supreme Court, and in a unanimous decision, they pretty well slapped down the notion that the president is too busy and important to be involved in legal matters like that. So based on that, many people believe there's a strong likelihood that the Supreme Court would likewise not protect a president from testifying before a special counsel.
So, Aisha, we just got a minute or so left. I want to talk a little bit to you about Mr. Trump's appearance at the convention of the NRA. He's in Dallas as we speak. Speaking about talking out of both sides of your mouth, he's done a little bit of that with the NRA, following the Parkland shooting and now appearing as their, you know, headliner at this conference. Where do things stand between the president and the National Rifle Association?
Well, the president and the NRA seem to be back on good terms, if they were ever not on good terms. The president, after Parkland, did try to say that he would stand up to the NRA, that they didn't have power over him like they do over other politicians. But ultimately, and he did kind of float some ideas like raising the age limits for long guns that the NRA didn't like. But ultimately, when he proposed or issued proposals from the White House, he ended up backing policies that were largely supported by the NRA. So the rhetoric that he kind of put out after Parkland wasn't really matched by actions. And now he's going to speak at the NRA, and we're expecting him to to tout his support for the Second Amendment and for gun rights, and not to really challenge the NRA too much on issues like gun safety and things of that nature. So the relationship seems to be going pretty well between him and the NRA.
Aisha Roscoe is a White House reporter for NPR. Before that, she was a White House reporter for Reuters, and she is a regular contributor to our humble little program. Aisha, it's great having you with NPR and great having you on Midday Today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andy Green is Baltimore Sun's editorial page editor, and Dr. Malia Cromer is a political scientist and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center, which conducts the Goucher poll. She's going to join us when we come back from a break. We'll talk about that poll as the race for the Democratic nomination for governor enters its final few weeks. By the way, there are lots of fun things to do in Baltimore this weekend, and I want to make two suggestions. Number one, the Flower Mart is in Mount Vernon, and at the American Visionary Arts Museum, the 20th annual Kinetic Sculpture Race launches tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, at the museum on Key Highway in Federal Hill. If you've never done it, it's definitely worth checking it out. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for checking us out today. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. Local schools have been in the news this week. In Baltimore, City Council President Jack Young has questions about an enrollment task force that he says isn't inclusive enough. And in Baltimore County, Interim Superintendent Verlita White was appointed to her position permanently in a split decision by the county school board, only to be thrown back into interim status by the Maryland Superintendent of Schools, Karen Salmon. And the chief of Prince George's County Schools, Kevin Maxwell, will leave his job at the end of the school year, a move that had become an issue in the Democratic primary for governor. And speaking of the race for governor, we are 42 days away from the start of early voting in the June primary. Goucher College released a poll last week that shows that whomever gets the nod for the nomination, he or she will have a tough race against a popular and well-financed incumbent governor, Larry Hogan. Dr. Malia Cromer is the political scientist who conducted that poll. She is the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College, and she joins us now in the studio. Good to see you, Malia.
Thanks for having me.
And Andy Green, the editorial editor of the Baltimore Sun, continues to be with us here as well. If you'd like to join the fray, 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter at midday WIPR. So, Malia, let me ask you a question that people ask me all the time. Every time I walk in the grocery store, I go to a restaurant, I hang out at a party, I'm at the gym, they say, who's going to win? So you're the pollster. Just tell us so we can get this over with.
Well, first and foremost, the polls are snapshots in time. They're not crystal balls. So I can't tell you who's going to win, but I can tell you right now that the governor is certainly doing, is besting right now his Democratic challengers. There's at least a double-digit gap between him and his closest competitors, those that being right now Rashawn Baker, Ben Jealousy, and Kevin Kabinets. And so what we see is sustained strong approval ratings, but a re-elect rate that are not as strong as his approval rating. So there is some sort of gap that's going on there. And I think that's actually the part that people need to focus on right now.
Yeah, and let's talk about the distinction between approval and re-elect rate. Pat McDonough, who's running for county executive to replace Mr. Kamenetz, who's term limited and running, as you mentioned, for governor, says, I don't care about the approval rating of Hogan because he and Hogan have no love lost between those two. He says it's the re-elect rate that matters. So what's the difference?
Well, first and foremost, they're not independent of each other. So the reason that Republican governor of Blue State is doing so well is because he has such strong approval ratings. So I think it's most important, I think they are distinctive numbers, but they're not independent of each other. So the other point, though, yeah, certainly. His reelect rate is hovering right in the mid-40s, but it's still, again, a solid 10 to 15 points higher than his next closest competitor. And we have a big chunk of the electorate still undecided. And so what we're going to see in the next coming months is certainly some firming up of those numbers. It's going to get closer, and we'll see how many of those undecided voters Hogan can attract to his camp, if that can push him over that magic number that pundits talk about, that 51%.
Yeah. And of course, this approval rating is around 60%, and in some places it's even higher. I've heard, for example, that in Baltimore County, it's 85%. So if Mr. Hogan, you know, does really, really well in Baltimore County, does really, really well in Western Maryland, really, really well in the Eastern Shore, places he did really well the last time, Andy Green, you know, he's going to be formidable. Plus, he's got about $10 million stashed in the back of his car, parked in his garage at the governor's mansion. And
well, let's hope not, because we don't want to get back into the campaign finance stuff. But yeah, I mean, Baltimore County is always the key when you have a competitive election, competitive general election in Maryland. It is the big swing jurisdiction, that's the place where Bob Ehrlich beat Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. It's the place where Martin O'Malley beat Bob Ehrlich. It's the place where Larry Hogan beat Anthony Brown. And that's where this is going to be, you know, if he's going to win, he has to do really well there. And so that's a place where Democrats will be looking to nip into his lead. But another thing to remember is that Hogan benefited from pretty soft turnout in the key Democratic jurisdictions of Montgomery, Prince George's, and Baltimore City 4 years ago. The question entirely this time around is, how strong is Democratic turnout going to be in a Trump-era election?
Yeah. And Malia Cromer, when it comes to, you know, the crucial sort of centrality of Baltimore County in the general election, is that going to give a boost to Mr. Kamenetz? Because that's the place he's been running for the last 8 years. I mean, is that a point of sale that he's going to be able to make that Rashawn Baker or Ben Jealous can't make?
Well, certainly for the primary election. So especially among these challengers, our previous poll back in February found there really wasn't a lot of daylight between a lot of the candidates because their name recognitions were so low. And so when you're sitting there in Baltimore County, a really important county, a very populous county, and your name recognition certainly for Kevin Kamenetz is high there in Baltimore County, it's good for you, particularly going into a primary election. But of course, you could argue the same thing for Rashawn Baker in Prince George's County,
which has more Democrats by a lot.
Exactly.
So in terms of a primary race, to get to the starting line for the general election, perhaps Mr. Baker does have the edge. I mean, is there a clear favorite among these top three? I mean, there are nine people on the ballot, seven of whom are considered pretty serious people. They include a state senator, Rich Mantaleno. They include a well-known lawyer who served in the upper echelons of the education establishment here, Jim Shea. Two young, very articulate and smart people, Alec Ross, Krish Vignaraja. It's an impressive field.
I think it is a really impressive field, but I think the Democrats need to really start paying attention to the race. And they need to take a long, hard look at these candidates and really start to make decisions. And the candidates need to make it easier for them by really drawing some distinctions between themselves. I've watched a lot of the forums. I've attended a few of the forums. And it seems like there's a lot of issues in which the candidates agree. And with a lot of high levels of agreement between the candidates, you don't have reasons to vote for one over the other. And that disagreement between the two, the choice is what makes the election interesting. Yeah, and so that's what we'll have to see in the next coming weeks.
Yeah, and Andy, your State House reporter who does a wonderful job, Aaron Cox, had a really good piece a week or so ago about how, because there's so many people in this race, I mean, there's seven really serious candidates here, the number of votes that it's going to take for any one person to get more votes
than small.
It's really small. It's like in the 125,000 range.
Right. They're thinking a quarter of the electorate might be all it takes for somebody to win this. And so what you've seen is, as Malia said, they're not disagreeing on the issues. They are doing very targeted campaigning, going after constituencies that they think they have an edge with. So, for example, for Rashern Baker, it's Prince George's County and the African-American community more broadly around the state. Ben Jealous is going after the Bernie Sanders voters and also African-American voters. Kevin Kamenetz has Baltimore County and some of the more conservative parts of the state that he's focusing on. Rich Mattolino is working hard to establish himself as the Montgomery County candidate. You go down the list, Krish Vignaraja is the only woman in the race, which is a very important constituency. And, obviously there's a lot more to her campaign than that, but that's a good path when you've got more than half of the electorate that you can appeal to in a way that others can't. Alec Ross is going after, young tech-savvy kind of voter. So, each of them has their path to victory that is at least somewhat plausible. Some of them obviously are more plausible than others, but they're not trying to kind of knock everybody else out. They're not doing a broad message. And an interesting thing, one of, I think, the most interesting things about this poll is how little difference there was top to bottom in the numbers of each Democrat versus Hogan. As Malia said, Hogan is beating them all by double digits, but the difference between the one who's doing best against him and the one who's doing worst against him is basically margin of error.
Yep.
Yeah. And when it comes to electability, all of the candidates, and I've now talked to six of the seven top candidates, and I'll be speaking with Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker next Friday here on Midday, and that'll clear the table for us in terms of talking to the people in the Democratic primary. They all point to this 22-24% undecided. Now, Malia, are they undecided because they're not paying attention, or are they undecided because they really can't make up their mind?
So it'd be really difficult for me to glean that exact information from our poll. But I will say, these are voters who are malleable, right? So these are voters, I think, that certainly once the Democratic primary is decided and they see who wins and they start to really pay attention, then you'll see that number slowly as we get closer and closer to Election Day, that undecided number gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But we'll find out probably in September and October where those undecideds really start to break pretty heavily.
And there's some really interesting Senate races in the Maryland legislature. The complexion of the Maryland legislature next year, Andy Green, is going to be unbelievably different. I think there's 40 members of the House of Delegates out of 141 members who will not be returning for one reason or the other next
year.
Right,
and some big names in the state Senate, too.
Yeah.
We've had a fair amount of turnover in the legislature the last two or three elections. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the last election before we get another round of redistricting. That's usually when you see the most change. But there are certainly places like Jim Brochen leaving the state Senate to run for Baltimore County Executive that, opens up a really big opportunity for Republicans. There are some other good opportunities for Republicans in Anne Arundel County on the Eastern Shore. So it's possible that, they could actually do well in the legislature despite the headwinds just based on retirements from the General Assembly.
Yeah, and it's interesting, within the Legislative Black Caucus, for example, there's a lot of controversy because there are some black legislators in the House who are challenging longtime Senate black legislators who felt like, you know, I've earned this spot here. I've been here for a long time. To kick me out of office would sacrifice all this seniority. Who are these young whippersnappers nipping at my heels? I mean, Malia, this is a really interesting year, isn't it?
Well, it's a larger conversation about what the blue wave actually means. Is the blue wave just to get ousts Republicans from office, or is it a replacement of sort of the old guard Democrat with a new type of, you know, younger, more progressive Democrat? And do you actually see this within the Democratic Party as well as just the Democratic Party push to get Republicans out of office? And so, yes, I think the composition of the Maryland General Assembly might look different. It might look more ideologically to the left if certain things fall certain ways.
And Malia, as a person who studies the public psyche as closely as you do, what do we make of the decision by a judge in Anne Arundel County, I guess, to keep Nathaniel Oakes's name on the ballot for Senate in the race that Jill Carter is facing with a newcomer to politics, but no newcomer to the political family? He's the son-in-law of Martin O'Malley. His name is J.D. Merrill. So Senator Oakes has been indicted. He has pled guilty. He's going to be sentenced. He's not going to be serving in the legislature next year, but he's going to be on the ballot. What will that do to that particular race? And by the way, I'll be speaking with Ms. Carter and Mr. Merrill next week here on Midday.
Well, I think one thing is for certain, you'll see a lot of signs outside of the polling places reminding voters on their way in that Nathaniel Oakes actually cannot be seated if he is for some reason wins re-election in that primary. Right. So, yeah, there will be some people that actually cast their vote for him. And that's unfortunate. But I don't. That's a more of a legal question than I think a public opinion question.
Yeah. So the rules on getting your name off the ballot in Maryland are pretty restrictive. The deadline to drop out is 2 days after the deadline to file. So that does not give a whole lot of time for events to intervene. And Nathaniel Oakes is not the only problem on the ballot this year. The late Senator Wayne Norman's name is still on the ballot,
right, too. And he passed away.
Yeah. And that is causing all kinds of complications in Harford County with who's running for what and these convoluted plans about how they're going to do some sort of switch later to get one person running for Zen, other person running for the House of Delegates. I don't even fully understand it. It's nuts. And then meanwhile, you've got Nathaniel Oakes, who not only requested that his name be taken off the ballot, he actually rescinded his voter registration to make himself ineligible, which persuaded an Anne Arundel County judge to say, okay, you've got to take his name off, but then the Court of Appeals reversed that. So,
Now we should say also that Mr. Oakes took his sweet darn time.
Oh, yes, right.
In this whole process. If he had done much or all of this earlier in the process, we would not be where we are.
Yes, as we wrote an editorial about it last week, we said, you know, Nathaniel Oakes is finally trying to do the right thing. Why is the state desperately trying to stop him? But I think we're going to see next year the legislature take a look at this because there has to be some way that for good and substantial reason people's names can be withdrawn from the ballot more than 2 days after the filing.
I'm reminded of Pat Paulson, the perennial presidential candidate back in the 70s, who said, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. You know, it gets more convoluted by the day. Andy, speaking of Mr. Oakes and the person who has been appointed to fill that seat, mm-hmm. who is Jill Carter.
Yeah, the former state delegate.
The former state delegate for this district. Her opponent, J.D. Merrill, did not want to be considered as the placeholder in this race, thought it would be a better deal to have everybody just sort of start from scratch. And the Democratic Central Committee...
Or maybe thought he wouldn't get it if he put his name in so took a strategic principled stand.
Yeah, there's that possibility as well. But the Democratic Central Committee couldn't really figure out who they wanted either, so they left it to, of all people, Larry Hogan to decide who should be the person representing that district between now and... January.
And go figure, Governor Hogan picked the person who might be helped by that in the election, who happens to be running against Martin O'Malley. So it's coincidence, I'm sure. Yeah, but
it's small to more.
Yeah. And so meanwhile, other Jill Carter-related news, she had
her current job
as head of the Civil Rights Office in Baltimore City in the Pew administration. This week, one of her deputies resigned abruptly after the son started asking questions about the fact that he had been disbarred a year before for sort of misuse of clients' funds. And Jill Carter said, well, I knew about that. I believe in second chances. I thought it wasn't a big deal. But again, as soon as somebody noticed it and asked questions about it, he was out of there. So this is yet another. There have been a few instances in the Pew administration of some incomplete vetting, let's say, of some top appointees that have led to problems like this. It's not just a Trump administration thing.
Indeed. And Malia Cromer, what do you make of this business in Baltimore County? Verlita White, the interim superintendent of schools, took over from Dallas Dance, who himself was removed because of, he retired, but then it later came to light and he's pled guilty to fraud charges. She's the interim superintendent. They say they have a search committee. They say they're looking for somebody. They look and they find her. They appoint her permanently. Everybody's happy. They're singing Kumbaya. They have a nice party. They raise a toast, have cookies and milk. And then the state's school superintendent, Karen Salmon, says, no, I don't think she's been vetted closely enough either. What's going on up there? And by the way, we've asked Ms. White to be our guest here on Midday on Tuesday, and it looks like that's going to happen. So we look forward to that.
So my comment there is how important education will play in this upcoming gubernatorial election. So on our last poll, we also asked a variety of different issues, who they trusted more, the Democratic leadership or Governor Larry Hogan. And Governor Larry Hogan does better than the Democratic leadership in terms of the public's confidence in every single economic issue. But where the Democrats do better is education and the environment. And so this is the issue that Democrats need to be very, very strong on. And you saw Kevin Kamenetz come out right away, immediately, when Verlita White was not named the superintendent, and saying this was Larry Hogan playing politics with education once again. And so you're going to see a back and forth between the governor and the Democratic establishment trying to lay blame or try to spin what happened here in Baltimore County.
Yeah, and in Prince George's County, we have Kevin Maxwell, who Ben Jealous and others were calling on Rashern Baker to fire.
And all three people running for Rashern Baker's job as well. And the Republican Party has been, state Republican Party has been making real hay out of this, saying, look, if this was Rashern Baker's handpicked guy, Rashern Baker took great pains to take control of the school system. He can't be trusted to manage the state if he can't handle this. And this is a political problem for Mr. Baker, because taking control of the school system was really one of his key accomplishments as Prince George's County Executive. Now, meanwhile, all of this churning of the water in Baltimore County is good for Larry Hogan, in the sense that it diminishes confidence in Democratic leadership in what we have said is a really crucial jurisdiction for him. It also is not great for Kevin Kamenetz, should Mr. Kamenetz get through the primary. So a lot of politics and education going on.
Indeed, and we will keep following it. That is all the time we have today. But thank you so much, Andy Green and Malia Cromer. It's good to see you both. I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Dr. Malia Cromer is a political science professor and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College, where she oversees the Goucher Poll. And Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, Dr. Sonia Santelices will be my guest. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. And as I mentioned, we're hoping to speak to Ms. Verlita White on Tuesday. But we'll get Dr. Santelices' view of how this school year has gone. It's entering its final weeks. And we're going to ask her about this controversy surrounding the enrollment task force. So that's all coming up Monday on Midday. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels and Patango Bakery and Cafe for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Available to Waverly and the JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Patango Bakery and Cafe is located on South Ann Street in historic Fells Point. They specialize in imported Italian charcuterie and house-made breads and pastries. They're open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Their menu and hours are on their website, patangogelato.com/ Bakery. By the way, thanks to everybody who came out to the Baltimore Museum of Industry last night for the Stoop storytelling event, Working It. I was honored to be invited to tell a story, and I enjoyed all of the other stories that we heard as well. So thanks to the BMI and Jessa Henkin and Laura Wexler and everybody who made it such a great and fun event. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coglin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. I'm not quite sure what I do, but I appreciate your hearing it. Have a great weekend.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.